In our school books, we are taught that the evil Germans wanted to genocide all the Jews. Ironically, there were no written German plans to exterminate the Jews. But on the other hand, there were many Jewish plans to exterminate the Germans. Jewish supremacists were openly calling for the genocide of the Germans. This was mainly the reason why the National Socialists viewed it as their mission to save the German people. But what is the motivation for the demographic genocide of the European people that we all can see around us today? Why is it necessary for a specific group of people to destroy the racial and cultural makeup of an entire continent and race of people? The answer to this can be found in the following disturbing plans. Baruch Levy stated in response to Karl Marx in La Revue de Paris, "The Jewish people as a whole will become its own messiah. It will attain world domination by the dissolution of other races, by the abolition of frontiers, the annihilation of monarchy, and by the establishment of a world republic in which the Jews will everywhere exercise the privilege of citizenship. In this new world order, the children of Israel will furnish all the leaders without encountering opposition. The governments of the different peoples forming the world republic will fall without difficulty into the hands of the Jews. It will then be possible for the Jewish rulers to abolish private property and everywhere to make use of the resources of the state. Thus, the promise of the Talmud will be fulfilled, in which is said that when the Messianic time is come, the Jews will have all the property of the whole world in their hands." The Jewish writer Israel Sangwill was a Fabian socialist and advocate of world government. He was very supportive of the Bolshevik Revolution and had close links to Jewish banking families such as the Rothschilds and the Schiffs. As early as in 1908, Sangwill coined the term melting pot when he wrote the famous play that premiered in Washington, D.C. in the heart of American political culture. The well-known term melting pot means the mixing of different races and cultures into one monolithic group, forming the new world and the new man. The play described an America in which all races and cultures are blended into a new people. But of course, Sangwill was an ardent Zionist and disapproved of Jewish intermarriage. The more blended everyone else is, the less organized and ethnocentric and anti-Semitic they will be. Thus, no one would know these, the ethnocentric Jews. Blending all people into a giant mishmash in all white countries was the idea planted by this play that appealed to many influential persons. When The Melting Pot opened on Broadway, it was critically praised by the globalist press and publicly praised by Teddy Roosevelt and Churchill. In reality, it is what multiculturalism was intended to be, the mixing of non-European populations with Europeans in European nations, with the intention of mixing the Europeans out of existence. It means the final solution for the white European people. After having conquered Christian Russia and turned it into a superstate Soviet Union, they would start the project of doing the same thing with Europe. National sovereignty and homogeneity of the European nations would have to be eliminated before international communism could be implemented. In 1922, Richard Nicholas von Coudenhove-Kalergi founded the Pan-European Movement, the ground of what we now refer to as the European Union. His ideas were the guiding principles behind the founding of the European Union. Very few people know that Kalergi explicitly designed the genocide of the Europeans through flooding Europe with migrants. His goal was to create a Europe without ethnic Europeans. Just like the Jewish Bolshevik Revolution, his movement was also financially backed by the Zionist Jewish capitalist bankers such as Rothschild, Baruch, and Warburg. The plan is no more than a supremacist strategy to outnumber and genocide the low birth rate, passive, ethno-masochistic, self-loading Europeans out of existence. Kalergi's goal was to destroy distinct cultures and genetic uniqueness and replace them with automized, rootless individuals. European immigration would be the first step in creating a future world government. From his book Praktischer Idealismus, Practical Idealism, K. came the concept now commonly called the Kudenhove Kalergi Plan. 2 points can summarize this plan. Europeans must mix with Arabs, Africans, and Asians into a mess which Kalergi describes as a Eurasian Negroid race. The only exception for the planetary race biological experiment are, of course, the Jews, as Kalergi considers to be Europe's intellectual upper class. Taking from his book Practical Idealism, Kalergi states, "Man will in future be of mixed race. Today's races and classes will gradually disappear as a result of the elimination of space, time, and prejudice. The future of Eurasian Negro race will remind you of ancient Egyptians and replace the diversity of races and the diversity of individuals. Instead of destroying European Jewry in Europe, against her will, we find and educated these people, and through this artificial process pushed them into their future role as the leading nation. Bolshevism constitutes a decisive step towards this purpose, where a small group of communist spiritual aristocrats govern the country. The general staff of both are recruited from Europe's spiritual leader race, the Jews." These crimes committed by the European Union against the European peoples are directly in violation of the 1948 UN Genocide Convention, Article 2. Kalergi suggested Beethoven's hymn as the European Union's national anthem, and he was very active with the design of the EU logo, which contains 12 stars, which symbolize the 12 tribes of Israel. The logo was finalized by the Jew Paul M.G. Levy. The European Union Parliament building in Strasbourg was modeled after the Tower of Babel, Hebrew name for Babylon. The building symbolized anti-Christianism, dependence on power, the destruction of global human diversity, and a gradual introduction of tyranny. In the Greek myth, Europa was a beautiful Phoenician princess. Europa caught the eye of Zeus, who promptly turned himself into a rather comely and attractive white bull, adorned with flowers and petals. At entrance, Europa climbed aboard the bull, only for it to whisk her away across the sea. Zeus, in the guise of the bull, took her all the way to Crete, where he raped Europa. Europa then went on to give birth to King Minos of Crete. This is the EU headquarters in Brussels. This is the sculpture outside of European Parliament in Strasbourg, literally called the Abduction of Europe. The Greek Eurocoin, Time magazine cover. So, the most obvious question we now should ask ourselves is the following. Why is the European Union using the rape of Europa from Greek myth as its primary symbol? Kudenhove Kalergi was a mixed breed, and although he was not Jewish himself, he was a member of the Jewish B'nai B'rith Masonry Lodge, and he could speak Hebrew. Two of his three wives were Jewish. Kudenhove Kalergi's father was a close friend of Theodor Herzl, the founder of Zionism. In 1897 in Switzerland, Herzl explained that Masonic lodges are established all over the world to help us achieve our independence. Those pigs, the non-Jewish Masons, will never understand the final objects of Masonry. Consequently, all Masonic lodges of Germany were closed down by the National Socialists, and Freemasonry was outlawed. Germany's National Socialist government considered the Pan-European Union to be under the control of Freemasonry, which they saw as a danger to Germany and Europe's future survival. In 1938, a book called Die Freimaurerie, Weltanschauung, Organisation und Politik was released, revealing Kudenhove Kalergi's membership of Freemasonry. The Masonic newspaper called The Beacon stated, "Brother Kudenhove Kalergi's program is a Masonic work of the highest order, and to be able to work on it together is a lofty task for all brother Freemasons." Freemasonry is ultimately rooted in the Jewish Kabbalah. Kabbalah is a Hebrew word for received tradition. The Jewish Tribune of New York on October 28, 1927 stated, "Masonry is based on Judaism. Eliminate the teachings of Judaism from the Masonic ritual, and what is left?" The well-known Rabbi Isaac Weiss concluded, "Freemasonry is a Jewish establishment whose history, grades, official appointments, passwords, and explanations are Jewish from beginning to end." Winston Churchill referred to Kalergi's plan in 1945 as the United States of Europe. Churchill himself was also a Freemason and a big supporter of the movement of creating this stepping stone to the future international communist government. After the annexation of Austria by the Third Reich in 1938, Kudinov Kalergi fled to Czechoslovakia and then again in 1940s from France to the US. Kalergi wrote in his autobiography, "At the beginning of 1924, we received a call from Baron Louis de Rothschild. One of his friends, Max Warburg from Hamburg, had read my book and wanted to get to know us. To my great surprise, Warburg spontaneously offered us 60,000 gold marks to tide the movement over for its first 3 years. Max Warburg, who was one of the most distinguished and wisest men that I have ever come in contact with, had a principle of financing these movements. He remained sincerely interested in pan-Europe for his entire life. Max Warburg arranged his 1925 trip to the United States to introduce me to Paul Warburg and financier Bernard Baruch." The well-known James Paul Warburg was a Jewish member of the Globalist Council on Foreign Relations and Roosevelt's financial advisor. James Paul Warburg gained some notice in February 1950 when he said, "We shall have world government, whether we like it or not. The only question is whether world government will be achieved by conquest or consent." James' father was banker Paul Moritz Warburg, member of the Warburg family and father of the Federal Reserve System. John Monnet was also one of the chief architects of the European Union. He was born into a family of Jewish merchants and spent his life fueled by hatred for Europeans. In his Monnet plan, he explained how he would turn the free Europe into a communist superstate. "Europe's nations should be guided towards a superstate without their people understanding what is happening. This can be accomplished by successive steps, each disguised as having an economic purpose, but will eventually and irreversibly lead to federation." The European Union was intentionally set up to give minority organizations influence on the management of Europe. Harry Truman read an article about Kalergi in 1945. He was so impressed that he adopted the Kalergi plan as a US official policy as well. After 1965, the real demographic changes of European countries would be seen. Brock Chisholm, former director of the World Health Organization, said, "What people in all places have to do is to limit of birth rates and promote mixed marriages between different races. This aims to create a single race in the world, which will be directed by a central authority." Theodore Kaufmann, an American Jew born in New York City, wrote the book Germany Must Perish in late 1940. This was a full year before the USA entered the Second World War, and also long before the stories of mass killings of Jews in Germany began to circulate. Kaufmann advocated for the genocide of the German people and called for the complete extermination of 48 million German men and women of childbearing age, so that, he explained, German nationalism and pride would be destroyed in two generations. Kaufmann advocated for genocide of the German people through forced sterilization and total dismemberment and reapportionment of German territory to be divided up and given to other nations. The hate fest started out in the opening lines of his book as following. "This dynamic volume outlines a comprehensive plan for the extinction of the German nation and a total eradication from the earth of all her people." Kaufmann continued for several chapters further demonizing Germans before proposing his genocidal final solution. On page 86, the author states, "There remains then but one mode of ridding the world forces of Germanism, and that is to stem the source from which issue those war-lusted souls. By preventing the people of Germany from ever again reproducing their kind, this modern method, known to science as eugenic sterilization, is at once practical, humane, and thorough. Sterilization has become a byword of science as the best means of ridding the human race of its misfits." Kaufmann's summary of his book in a Times ad read, "A dynamic volume outlining a plan for the extinction of Germany. containing a map showing possible dissection and apportionment of its territory. The plan boiled down to forcible mass sterilization of most German women under 45 and most German men under 65. Incredibly, a number of Jewish-owned newspapers in America actually reviewed the book when it was published, including New York Times, The Washington Post, Time Magazine, and the Philadelphia Record. Kaufman was, just like many other Jewish supremacists, a big proponent of a world government. On 26th of September 1941, Kaufman said in an interview he gave to the Canadian Jewish Chronicle, "I believe that the Jews have a mission in life. They must see to it that the nations of the world get together in one vast federation, and the Jews will do the most to bring about this confederation, because they have the most to gain. But how can you get peace if Germany exists? Let us sterilize all Germans." In Germany, leaflets were printed to expose this book and inform the public about the plans. The leaflets also revealed that Roosevelt, Churchill, and Stalin supported versions of the plan. The leaflet presented a reproduction of Kaufman's 8-point plan and captioned, "German people, you now know what your eternal enemies plan to do. To stop their extermination plan, there is only one thing to do: fight, work, and win." The plan was inspired by Talmudic hatred for the Germans, who had dared to oppose the God's chosen people. A million copies of the small book were republished in German by order from Joseph Goebbels to warn Germans of their possible fate if the war was lost. Hitler read a copy of the book in August of 1941 and was terrified with what he read. Afterwards, Jews were forced to wear the yellow star by law. The editor of the Zionist weekly Jüdische Rundschau was the first to coin and make popular the slogan about the yellow star, which Jews were later forced to wear. "Wear it proudly, the yellow badge." Dr. Joseph Goebbels stated, "Thanks to the Jew Kaufman, we Germans know only too well what to expect in case of defeat. Humanity would sink into eternal darkness. It would fall into a dull and primitive state were the Jews to win this war." In an article headlined "Breed War Strains Out of Germans" in the New York Daily newspaper, January 4, 1943, the Jewish Harvard University professor Ernest Houghton laid out his outbreeding plan that would destroy German nationalism. Houghton also called for the flooding of Europe with non-Europeans. Houghton's proposal called for transforming the German nation by encouraging mating of German women with non-German men, who would be brought into the country in large numbers, and of German men forcibly held outside of Germany with non-German women. 10 to 12 million German men would be assigned to forced labor under Allied supervision in countries outside of Germany to rebuild their economies. "The objects of this measure," wrote Dr. Houghton, "include reduction of the birth rates of pure Germans, neutralization of German aggressiveness by outbreeding and denationalization of indoctrinated individuals." Houghton estimated that this plan would require at least 20 years to be implemented. During this period, he went on, "encourage also the immigration and settlement in the German states of non-German nationals, especially males." In September 1944, a French clergyman announced from the pulpit, "What remains to be done is to kill every German. There must be no distinction between soldiers and civilians in the destruction of men, women, and children." The Morgenthau Plan was yet another plan for the occupation or for the post-war destruction of Germany to inflict collective punishment upon the German people. The plan was authorized by two extremely powerful Jews around Roosevelt, Henry Morgenthau and Harry Dexter White. Morgenthau hoped for a Jewish revenge against the Germans to give her over to his Red friends in Moscow. The plan aimed at, by means of aggressive warfare and starvation, reducing Germany's population with at least 20 million people. The plan was that Germany would be deindustrialized and to become a poor agricultural society again. The plan was supported by Roosevelt and Churchill. Morgenthau was a close friend and personal advisor to President Franklin Roosevelt and played a major role in financing US participation in World War II. Motivations for the plan included resentment against the entire German people, to permanently destroy Germany as a major power, to make her never rise against the globalists again, as a measure to prevent Germany from becoming a great military power again in the future. The Gauls would fulfill their vision of weakening and dividing the Western European countries to increase the support for communism in Germany and elsewhere. Franklin Roosevelt quickly grew fond of the plan and agreed that Germans had to be exterminated. "We have got to be tough with Germany, and I mean the German people, not just the Nazis. You either had to castrate the German people, or you have got to treat them in such a manner so they can't go on reproducing people." Morgenthau released a book in 1945 entitled Germany is Our Problem, which promoted his plan and described it in detail. In November of 1945, Dwight Eisenhower, governor of the U.S. occupation zone of Germany, approved the distribution of 1,000 copies of this book to top American military officials.
The black-haired Jewish boy waits with satanic delight on his face for the hour when he can corrupt the unsuspecting girl with his blood and, in seducing her, steal her from her people. The Jew will attempt to undermine the racial foundations of the nation to be conquered using every possible means. The Jew steadily works to ruin women and girls so that he can break down the barriers of blood on an even larger scale. It was the Jews who brought the Negro to the Rhine. The motive behind this is clear, and his intention is always the same. He wants to destroy the hated white race through bastardization. He continues to bring Negroes in as a flood and forces the mixing of races. This corruption puts an end to the white culture and political distinction and raises the Jew up to be its masters. A racially pure people, which is conscious of its blood, can never be defeated by the Jew. In this world, the Jew can only be the master of bastards. This is why he continually tries to lower the racial quality by poisoning the blood of individuals among the targeted peoples. The Jew begins to replace the political idea of democracy with that of a dictatorship for the working class. In the organized masses who follow Marxism, the Jew finds he is holding a weapon that allows him to do without democracy and permits him instead to conquer and rule the people through the iron hand of a dictatorship. The Jew works systematically in two directions, for the revolution economically and politically. Any nation that violently resists his internal attack is surrounded by a net of countries which fall more easily. This ring forms a network of enemies around his target and incites the nation into war. And finally, if necessary, when the troops are on the battlefield, he raises the flag of revolution right when the country is least prepared. Economically, the Jew shakes the state until its social services begin to sway. They become so costly that they are transferred away from national control and put under his financial control. Politically, he blocks funding and denies the state access to the resources it needs for self-preservation. He destroys the foundations of any national resistance or defense. He destroys faith in the government leadership. He ridicules the nation's history, and he drags everything that is truly great into the gutter. Culturally, the Jew corrupts art, literature, and theater. He makes fun of national sentiment, upsets all ideas of beauty and nobility and idealism, and anything good. He drags people down into the realm of his own lowest nature. Religion is made ridiculous, and morals and decency are represented as old and worn out. He continues his attack until the last support on which the national being must rest, which the nation needs if it is to fight for survival in this world, is gone.
One of the many lies about Hitler and the National Socialists was that they considered other races in general as subhuman. But this is false post-war propaganda. Hitler has become the symbol of racism, even though he only applied the racialism that is considered normal to all other races around the world. It's only racism when white people defend their own nations and advocate for their own interests, because anti-racism is only a code word for anti-white. For example, the term master race was never even used during the Third Reich. The word Herrenvolk, gentleman people, was mistranslated into English as master race. The correct term Herrenvolk merely implied that the German was master of himself and his own country. He was independent. He possessed Selbstbeherrschung, self-control. He was Herr der Lage, master of the situation. He was Herr im Haus, master in his own house. Regarding the misunderstood concept of Lebensraum, Ingrid Rimland explained, "Our history has been stolen from us, words have been stolen from us, concepts have been stolen from us, and Lebensraum is such a concept. Lebensraum is not, in and of itself, a bad word. It means living space. It means the freedom to breathe, to grow, to become, the right to be a nation. It does not mean brutality against other races." Similarly, the term Untermensch was not necessarily tied to any special race. It simply meant a person subjecting to the immoral mindset of communism. The Untermensch is more a character of man. Goebbels himself said, "Subhumans exist in all peoples as a living agent." By contrast, Jewish supremacists themselves refer to the non-Jewish peoples as Gentiles or Goyim, to be treated as cattle or slaves, where murder, rape, or mistreatment of the Goyim is commanded and acceptable. The term master race is in fact something that the Jewish supremacists use to describe their own race. The Aryan master race is pure projection by the Jews to try to shift blame to the Germans for their own Jewish racism.
כתוב, אתם קוראים אודום ואין הם קוראים אודום.
זהו, אבל לא הם בהמות.
אה, נכון, לא כתוב שהם בהמות.
אבל יש לזה הסבר על זה, נכון?
רגע, זה מה שאני רוצה להבין. רגע, שקט. אז מי, כן, מה כתוב? זה מה שאני לא מבין.
כתוב שאתם קוראים אדם, והגויים לא קוראים אדם, זה מה שכתוב.
לא קוראים?
לא קוראים אדם, לא קוראים להם אדם.
אוקיי, אז מה קוראים להם?
אדם זה אדמה.
אדם הוא בן אדם שהוא שונה מהבהמה. אם הבן אדם עושה את מעשה הבהמה, אז הוא לא, אז הוא כמו הבהמה, מה זה שווה? כל בן אדם צריך לשלוט על עצמו.
אוקיי.
זה היהודים שולטים על עצמם.
אוקיי.
היצר אומר להם לעשות דבר והם לא עושים. אז הוא בן אדם.
אוקיי, ומישהו שהוא לא יהודי, אבל יש מישהו שהוא לא יהודי שעושה מה שצריך, הוא בן אדם או לא בן אדם?
צריך לעשות דברים נורמליים, בדרך כלל הם עושים, הם יכולים להרוג אנשים שלא רואים אותם. יהודי לא ירוג יהודי, אפילו שלא לא רואים אותם. אם אחד זה גוי, כן?
אבל יש יהודים שהורגים יהודים.
זה קושי. יש כל יש.
יגאל עמיר, רבי פופר.
יהודי שמתנהג כמו יהודי, ודאי יש יהודים שלא מתנהגים.
אוקיי, אבל רגע, מה שאני לא מבין, זה כל הגויים הם איך קוראים?
תקשיב שנייה, אדוני.
בהמות.
אני יכול להגיד לך משהו?
אם יש להם, אם אין להם ציבור.
אדם, שנייה, אדם זה על שם אדמה לעליון. אוקיי. אוקיי? זה פירוש אדם. אנחנו הפכנו את זה, זאת אומרת, העם הפך את זה. האדם בן אדם, כמובן, אתה בן אדם, אתה צריך להתנהג כמו בן אדם. אבל בעיקרון זה על שם עליון. אדם זה אדם אל עליון, וכיוון שאנחנו פנים של אלוקים, אז הוא קרא לנו בן אדם. עכשיו, הגויים מה שהם, כן? אלוקים עשה אותם בשביל שיעשו פה...
בשביל לשרת את היהודים. כל הגויים שאתה רואה שיש בעולם, המיליארדים האלה, הם הכל רק בשביל... שהיהודים יהיה להם איזה תועלת.
עכשיו,
אנחנו לא רואים את זה, אנחנו לא יודעים בדיוק.
כן, היות ואנחנו בגלות, אז אוטומטי עדיין הם עוד לא משרתים אותנו לגמרי, רק חלקית.
כל אחד יהיה לו, כשמישהו יבוא, אז כל אחד יהיה לו...
יהיה לו
אלפים עבדים.
בינתיים, המשיח לא כאן, אז איך הם משרתים אותנו?
הם מבונים לנו רכבים,
דירות,
בניינים. למי הם בונים את זה? לנו. משרתים את היהודים.
So, did Hitler want to take over the world? No. Again, this is just projection by the writers of history. In reality, the same people who accused Hitler of wanting world domination were actually themselves guilty of wanting to take over the world. Churchill, for example, accused Hitler of trying to take over the world at a time when his own country controlled the largest empire in history. The Jewish communists accused Hitler of trying to take over the world when the Communist International, Comintern, had explicitly said that they fought for world domination and had already occupied most of the world's countries through total control of their media, banking, and politics. Hitler, of course, wished for the whole world to adopt nationalism, to defend themselves against the evils of globalism. But he also made it absolutely clear that he did not want to force anyone else to adopt national socialism. The National Socialists were not Aryan supremacists. They simply wanted to preserve their own race and preserve the true biological diversity in the world and be the leaders of their own nation. In accordance with nature's laws, nothing is more right than the preservation of one's own race. Having pride in and love for your own race and wanting to ensure its survival is not a crime. It is the most natural feeling in the world. No matter what the anti-white media says, true nationalism represents true global diversity. Love of your own race and culture does not mean hatred of other races. The National Socialists believe that every people had the right to preserve their own unique heritage, culture, character, art, literature, music, values, faith, and other characteristics that define them in their own countries. All races have the right to live in peace in their own homelands, free from the threat of demographic replacement. Globalism and cultural Marxism represent anti-diversity because they want to water us all down, destroy racial identity and the unique distinctions between the divergent races, making us all the same. The melting pot concept that the globalists are promoting for white European nations is in fact anti-true diversity and seeks to eradicate diversity at the same time as deceptively championing it. The real racists and supremacists are those in favor of forced mass immigration or miscegenation to destroy a nation's unique individual character, beauty, and culture. People from all over the world united behind Germany. Many people saw straight through the propaganda that was being launched against Hitler in the media. Hundreds of thousands of Slavic, Russians, Arabs, Asian, Indians, Blacks, and even Native Americans wore the eagle and the swastika proudly on their breast. The Nuremberg racial laws have been regarded particularly racist as they reduced the rights of the Jews in Germany. The laws also prohibited marriage between Jews and Gentiles. However, Zionists and National Socialists actually cooperated before the war on writing these racial laws. These laws were supported by the Jews themselves, who did not want to mix their blood with Gentiles. Mike Walsh said, "Racially mixed marriages were and are as much anathema to Jews as they were to Hitler." Hitler simply put in Germany first laws. Is it really that bizarre to keep Germany German? Most states in the USA had also enacted laws prohibited marriage between persons of different races at the same time. The Liberian Constitution states that only black people can be citizens. So why aren't anti-racist groups screaming at Liberia? Why is this not front page news? Well, because no one cares that there is a country only for black people. What about the homogeneous ethno-state Japan, with a Japanese population of 99%? Afghanistan, Saudi Arabia, Somalia, and Yemen is 100% Muslim. Well, what about Israel? Is it racist for the Jews to keep Israel Jewish as well? Is it racist for Jews to put Israel first also? Interestingly, Israel would enact much more discriminative racial laws within their own Jewish ethnostate some years later. In Israel, it is illegal for Jews to marry a non-Jew. Palestinians within Israel are granted different rights to Jews. They are not allowed freedom of movement. Their towns receive less government funding than Jewish towns. They receive heavier prison terms than Jews, and they experience employment discrimination as public funding is not equal. Israel has a completely racially based immigration policy and only allows people of biological Jewish descent to immigrate to the nation. Jews are granted citizenship to Israel, but Gentiles are not. A great wall was enacted keeping immigrants out of the nation. Israel recognizes less than 1% of the asylum seekers. Jews in America and Europe are 100% united in demanding open borders and immigration reform, but at the same time hypocritically support Israel, which now uses DNA tests on potential immigrants in order to keep the Jewish state racially pure. Israel's law of return immigration policy is directly based upon the National Socialist Nuremberg race laws, which define the Jew as anyone with two or more Jewish grandparents. This law of return is not based on religion, but biological Jewish ancestry. The racial laws that were criticized in National Socialist Germany by the Jewish community became the national standard of laws in Israel, enacted by the same Jewish community.
Can we speak, guys? We ask you some questions?
Not much.
About
politically?
A little bit.
No.
I'd love to hear your thoughts on the current conflict. But though everything's happening, it's all an illusion?
Yes.
Yeah. Wow. That guy is one of the greatest optimists I've ever seen. How you doing? Can I ask you a couple questions?
Yeah.
Yep. So somebody just threw a water balloon at us. And now there's a crowd gathering because they're going to, they're saying that they're going to chase us away, and they're gathering numbers now. So there's a big flock of people that's going to chase us. Yeah. I'm not. So I'm not allowed to talk to anybody in the country? I'd say we're not very wanted around here. This place is no joke. We were down there just trying to talk to people.
What do you see here? Of majority of people here don't think like them.
Yeah, I think we found enough peace here today. It's no joke. I'm going to my car. I'm going to my car. Yeah.
Jewish?
I'm going to my car.
There's so many things that are wrong on both sides. If this was solved tomorrow, if suddenly there were two states and people were living in peace, would Bin Laden go away? I don't think it would happen. But what you're doing is you're taking an argument away.
Dude, this is messed up. There goes my friend. See you.
Professor Dr. Walter Gross, director of the Racial Policy Office of the NSDAP, said, "We do not say that one race is superior to another, but we do say that there is a difference between the various races of the world." He also clarified in an article, "Most open to misinterpretation are National Socialist views on the relations between the various races of the world. It has been questioned whether the fundamental racial principles of the New World Theory must not breed condescension, even contempt of people of different race. Quite the contrary, these very principles offer the very best guarantee for mutual tolerance and for the peaceful cooperation of all. We appreciate the fact that those of another race are different from us. This scientific truth is the basis, the justification, and at the same time, the obligation of every racial policy without which a restoration of Europe in our day is no longer practicable. Whether that other race is better or worse is not possible for us to judge. The racial principles of National Socialism are, therefore, the surest guarantee for respecting the integrity of other nations. National Socialist demand is only that the claims of the blood and the laws of biology should be more closely observed in the future. We do not wish our people to intermarry with those of alien race, since through such mingling of blood, the best and characteristic qualities of both races are lost. But we will always have a ready welcome for any guests who wish to visit us, whether of kindred or foreign civilization, and our racial views only lead us to a fuller appreciation of their essential peculiarities, in the same way as we would want our own peculiarities respected. If all nations would follow the policies formulated by Dr. Walter Gross, the world would consist of free, independent, and homogeneous states, which would not be easily controlled by the global elite. Leon Degrelle explained eloquently, German racialism has been deliberately distorted. It never was anti-other race racialism. It was a pro-German racialism. It was concerned with making the German race strong and healthy in every way. Hitler was not interested in having millions of degenerates, if it was his power not to have them. Today one finds rampant alcohol and drug addiction everywhere. Hitler cared that the German families be healthy, cared that they raise healthy children for the renewal of a healthy nation. German racialism meant rediscovering the creative values of their own race, rediscovering their culture. It was a search for excellence, a noble idea. National Socialist racialism was not against the other races. It was for its own race. It aimed at defending and improving its race, and wished that all other races did the same for themselves. National Socialist racialism was loyal to the German race and totally respected all other races. Savitri Devi was a teacher, author, and political activist. She was a prominent proponent of animal rights, deep ecology, and National Socialism. She served the Axis cause during World War II by spying on Allied forces in India. She believed that Hitler was a sacrifice for humanity, and she had this to say about race. Respect the man of noble races other than your own, who carries out in a different place a combat parallel to yours, to ours. He is your ally. He is our ally, be he at the other end of the world. I am for a multiracial world in which each race keeps to itself, in harmony with other races. Like in a garden, you have flower beds of roses and flower beds of carnations and irises and different other flowers. They don't intermarry, they stay separate, and each one has its beauty. From all parts of the world, many volunteers rushed to help their German brothers in defense of Europe. The German army was in fact the most religiously diverse and largest multiracial fighting force in human history. Volunteers from the following countries joined Germany and fought for the Third Reich: Albania, Australia, Armenia, Argentina, Azerbaijan, Belgium, Bulgaria, Bosnia-Herzegovina, China, Canada, Croatia, Denmark, Estonia, Finland, France, Greece, Georgia, Hungary, India, Indonesia, Iceland, Ireland, Iran, Iraq, Italy, Korea, Latvia, Libya, Lithuania, Luxembourg, Lebanon, Netherlands, North Africa, South Africa, Norway, Poland, Palestine, Portugal, Romania, Serbia and Montenegro, Slovakia, Syria, Slovenia, Spain, Russia, Sweden, Switzerland, United Kingdom, Ukraine, Turkey, USA, and Egypt. I promise you, I'm quite free from all racial hatred. It is in any case undesirable that one race should mix with another. pride in one's own race, and that does not imply contempt for other races, is also a normal and healthy sentiment. I have never regarded the Chinese or the Japanese as being inferior to ourselves. They belong to ancient civilizations, and I admit freely that their past history is superior to our own. They had the right to be proud of their past, just as we had the right to be proud of the civilization to which we belong. Indeed, I believe the more steadfast the Chinese and the Japanese remain in their pride of their race, the easier I shall find it to get on with them. Although Germany wanted to keep Germany German, visiting people of other races were of course welcome. African-American Olympian athlete Jesse Owens had been warned before the Olympics that the racist German crowd might be hostile and yell insults. Instead, the crowd gave him several thunderous ovations. Owens later remarked that he had received the best ovations of his career at the Berlin Olympics. After winning 4 gold medals at the 1936 Olympics in Berlin, Owens was not recognized or invited to the White House by either American presidents Franklin D. Roosevelt or his successor Harry S. Truman. Instead, it was Hitler who gave Owens a special commemorative gift. Anti-German propaganda claimed that a furious Hitler had ignored 4-time Olympic gold medalist Jesse Owens. However, in his 1970 autobiography, Owens himself wrote, "When I passed the Chancellor, he rose, waved his hand at me, and I waved back at him. I think the writer showed bad taste in criticizing the man of the hour in Germany. Hitler did not snub me. It was Roosevelt who snubbed me. The president did not even send me a telegram." Jesse Owens said on numerous occasions that he was actually treated better in Nazi Germany than in segregated America. In America, Owens had trouble walking down the streets without getting harassed by racists. In Germany, Owens had trouble walking down the streets because the Germans kept stopping him to shake hands and congratulate him. Owens had only positive things to say about National Socialist Germany. One of the famous American Tuskegee Airmen, Alexander Jefferson, wrote a book called Red Tail Captured, Red Tail Free, where he talked about being a second-class citizen in his own country. He was shut down and put into a German POW camp, where he, for the first time in his life, wasn't segregated from the white troops. He recalls the incredible irony of finally being freed and returning home, and no sooner did he walk off the ship when he was told, "Whites to the right, niggas to the left." The black historian and sociologist W.E.B. Du Bois visited National Socialist Germany in 1936. He related that he received more respect from the German academics than from his white colleagues back in America. He was treated like a human being in Germany and stated, "The National Socialists did not show any trace of racial hatred toward blacks." The American diplomat and author Lawrence Dennis, who was biracial, born to a black mother and white father, also visited National Socialist Germany. Like Du Bois and other blacks who visited, he was treated warmly and like a human being for one of the first times in his life. He met and had discussions with Adolf Hitler himself. Dennis even attended the Nuremberg rallies. He was so impressed with Adolf Hitler's Germany that he thought National Socialism could save the United States as well. Contrary to what we've been taught by the Victor's propaganda, Hitler did not hate all Jews. Hitler's Jewish doctor, Edward Bloch, who also had treated his cancer-stricken mother, was protected by the SS. On Hitler's order, Bloch was given special protection. Hitler called him an Edel Jude, noble Jew. Hitler said, "I have nothing against the Jews themselves, but the Jews are all communists, and these are my enemies. It is these I am fighting. All Jews stick together like burrs It is up to the Jews themselves to draw a dividing line between these different kinds, but they have not done that, and therefore I must proceed uniformly against all Jews. Philip Friedman stipulated, the Third Reich treated Christianized Jews preferentially. The National Socialist Third Reich carefully distinguished between Talmudic and Christianized Jews. One of Hitler's closest comrades from the earliest days of the movement was Emil Maurice, who was Jewish. Maurice also was Hitler's one-time chauffeur, bodyguard, and permanent companion for many years. Hitler regularly attended concerts, and one of his favorite composers was Gustav Mahler, who was Jewish. The opera composer Franz Lehár was married to a Jewess, but he was the recipient to Hitler's highest musical award. Over 800 Jews lived openly with synagogue services in a Jewish hospital in Berlin during the war. In early 1938, 10% of the practicing lawyers in Germany were Jews. Jewish doctors and dentists were still participating in the German state compulsory insurance program, Ortskrankenkasse. 680,000 Jews were still living in the Third Reich by 1939. With Hitler's knowledge and approval, as many as 150,000 soldiers with Jewish blood served in the German military, including decorated veterans and high-ranking officers, even generals and admirals. Brian Mark Rigg, history professor at the American Military University in Virginia, said that these issues of soldiers of Jewish descent was long a somewhat taboo subject, overlooked by most academics. Many senior officers with Jewish ancestry even won special permission to serve from Hitler himself. Brian traced the Jewish ancestry of more than 1,200 of Hitler's soldiers, including 2 field marshals, 15 generals, 2 full generals, 8 lieutenant generals, 5 major generals commanding up to 100,000 troops. 20 Jews won the Reich's highest military honor, the Knight's Cross. Jews also served in the National Socialist Police and security forces as ghetto police, Ordnungsdienst, and concentration camp guards, Kapos. History is actually not so black and white. Many brave and German-friendly men with Jewish blood fought shoulder to shoulder with Germany against the Jewish Bolshevism. Most notably, former Chancellor and Luftwaffe General Helmut Schmidt and Luftwaffe Field Marshal Erhard Misch. Despite his Jewish heritage, Werner Goldberg appeared in the Berliner Tageblatt as the ideal German soldier, and his image was later used in recruitment posters for the Wehrmacht. Every German soldier received a copy of the German soldier's 10 commandments and was expected to follow them to the letter or face serious punishment. The only exception to these rules of conduct was in dealing with the murderous communist partisans who refused to recognize rules of warfare. For this reason, non-uniform partisan prisoners who refused to surrender were sometimes hanged or shot as war criminals, not as legitimate POWs.